staring into the man's face, and suddenly seizing him by the shoulders he flung him violently to the floor. But the police were on the spot, and he was seized. He screamed furiously. And all the time he was being removed, he yelled and screamed something incoherent. The whole court was thrown into confusion. I don't remember everything as it happened. I was excited myself and could not follow. I only know that afterwards, when everything was quiet again and everyone understood what had happened, the court usher came in for a reprimand, though he very reasonably explained that the witness had been quite well, that the doctor had seen him an hour ago when he had a slight attack of giddiness, but that, until he'd come into the court, he had talked quite consecutively, so that nothing could have been foreseen, that he had in fact insisted on giving evidence. But before everyone had completely regained their composure and recovered from this scene, it was followed by another. Katerina Ivanovna had an attack of hysterics. She sobbed, shrieking loudly, but refused to leave the court, struggled, and besought them not to remove her. Suddenly she cried to the president, "There is more evidence I must give at once. At once. Here is a document, a letter. Take it, read it quickly, quickly. It's a letter from that monster, that man there, there." She pointed to Mitya. "It was he killed his father. You will see that directly. He wrote to me how he would kill his father. But the other one is ill. He's ill, he's delirious." She kept crying out beside herself. The court usher took the document she held out to the president, and she, dropping into her chair, hiding her face in her hands, began convulsively and noiselessly sobbing, shaking all over, and stifling every sound for fear she should be ejected from the court. The document she'd handed up was that letter Mitya had written at the Metropolis Tavern, which Ivan had spoken of as a mathematical proof. Alas, its mathematical conclusiveness was recognized, and had it not been for that letter, Mitya might have escaped his doom, or at least that doom would have been less terrible. It was, I repeat, difficult to notice every detail. What followed is still confused to my mind. The president must, I suppose, have at once passed on the document to the judges, the jury, and the lawyers on both sides. I only remember how they began examining the witness. On being gently asked by the president whether she had recovered sufficiently, Katerina Ivanovna exclaimed impetuously, "I'm ready, I'm ready. I'm quite equal to answering you," she added, evidently still afraid that she would somehow be prevented from giving evidence. She was asked to explain in detail what this letter was, and under what circumstances she received it.
"I received it the day before the crime was committed, but he wrote it the day before that, at the tavern. That is, 2 days before he committed the crime. Look, it is written on some sort of bill," she cried breathlessly. "He hated me at the time because he'd behaved contemptibly, and was running after that creature, and because he owed me that 3,000... Oh, he was humiliated by that 3,000 on account of his own meanness. That is how it happened about that 3,000. I beg you, I beseech you to hear me. 3 weeks before he murdered his father, he came to me one morning. I knew he was in want of money, and what he wanted it for. Yes, yes, to win that creature and carry her off. I knew then that he had been false to me and meant to abandon me. And it was I who gave him that money, who offered it to him on the pretext of his sending it to my sister in Moscow. And as I gave it to him, I looked him in the face and said that he could send it when he liked. In a month's time would do. How could he have failed to understand that I was practically telling him to his face, 'You want money to be false to me with your creature? So here's the money for you. I give it to you myself. Take it, if you have so little honor as to take it.' I wanted to prove what he was. And what happened? He took it and squandered it with that creature in one night. But he knew that I knew all about it. I assure you he understood, too, that I gave him that money to test him, to see whether he was so lost to all sense of honor as to take it from me. I looked into his eyes, and he looked into mine, and he understood it all, and he took it. He carried off my money."
"That's true, Katya," Mitya roared suddenly. "I looked into your eyes, and I knew that you were dishonoring me, and yet I took your money. Despise me as a scoundrel. Despise me, all of you. I've deserved it." "Prisoner," cried the president, "another word, and I will order you to be removed."
"That money was a torment to him," Katya went on with impulsive haste. "He wanted to repair it to me. He wanted to, that's true, but he needed money for that creature, too. So he murdered his father, but he didn't repay me, and went off with her to that village where he was arrested. There again he squandered the money he'd stolen after the murder of his father. And a day before the murder he wrote me this letter. He was drunk when he wrote it. I saw it at once at the time. He wrote it from spite, and feeling certain, positively certain, that I should never show it to anyone, even if he did kill him, or else he wouldn't have written it. For he knew I shouldn't want to revenge myself and ruin him. But read it. Read it attentively. More attentively, please. And you will see that he had described it all in his letter, all beforehand, how he would kill his father and where his money was kept. Look, please, don't overlook that. There's one phrase there. I shall kill him as soon as Ivan has gone away. So he thought it all out beforehand, how he would kill him.
Katerina Ivanovna pointed out to the court with venomous and malignant triumph. Oh, it was clear she'd studied every line of that letter and detected every meaning underlining it.
If he hadn't been drunk, he wouldn't have written to me, but look, everything is written there beforehand, just as he committed the murder after. A complete programme of it,
she exclaimed frantically. She was reckless now of all consequences to herself, though no doubt she had foreseen them even a month ago. For even then, perhaps, shaking with anger, she'd pondered whether to show it at the trial or not. Now she had taken the fatal plunge. I remember that the letter was read aloud by the clerk, directly afterwards, I believe. It made an overwhelming impression. They asked Mitya whether he admitted having written the letter.
"It's mine! Mine!" cried Mitya. "I shouldn't have written it if I hadn't been drunk. We've hated each other for many things, Katya, but I swear I loved you even while I hated you, and you didn't love me."
He sank back on his seat, wringing his hands in despair. The prosecutor and counsel for the defense began cross-examining her, chiefly to ascertain what had induced her to conceal such a document, and to give her evidence in quite a different tone and spirit just before.
"Yes, yes, I was telling lies just now. I was lying against my honor and my conscience. But I wanted to save him, for he has hated and despised me so."
Katya cried madly.
"Oh, he has despised me horribly. He's always despised me. And, you know, he's despised me from the very moment that I bowed down to him for that money. I saw that. I felt it at once at the time. But for a long time I wouldn't believe it. How often I've read it in his eyes. You came of yourself, though. Oh, he didn't understand. He had no idea why I ran to him. He can suspect nothing but baseness. He judged me by himself. He thought everyone was like himself."
Katya hissed furiously in a perfect frenzy.
"And he only wanted to marry me because I'd inherited a fortune because of that. Because of that. I always suspected it was because of that. Oh, he is a brute. He was always convinced that I should be trembling with shame all my life before him, because I went to him then, and that he had a right to despise me forever for it. And so to be superior to me, that's why he wanted to marry me. That's so, that's all so. I tried to conquer him by my love, a love that knew no bounds. I even tried to forgive his faithlessness. But he understood nothing. Nothing. How could he understand, indeed? He's a monster. I only received that letter the next evening. It was brought me from the tavern. And only that morning I wanted to forgive him everything. Everything. Even his treachery."
The president and the prosecutor, of course, tried to calm her. I can't help thinking that they felt ashamed of taking advantage of her hysteria and of listening to such avowals. I remember hearing them say to her, "We understand how hard it is for you. Be sure we're able to feel for you," and so on, and so on. And yet they dragged the evidence out of the raving, hysterical woman. She described at last with extraordinary clearness, which is so often seen, though only for a moment, in such overwrought states, how Ivan had been nearly driven out of his mind during the last 2 months trying to save the monster and murderer, his brother.
"He tortured himself," she exclaimed. "He was always trying to minimize his brother's guilt and confessing to me that he too had never loved his father and perhaps desired his death himself. Oh, he has a tender, over-tender conscience. He tormented himself with his conscience. He told me everything, everything. He came every day and talked to me as his only friend. I have the honour to be his only friend.
She cried suddenly with a sort of defiance, and her eyes flashed.
He had been twice to see Smerdyakov. One day he came to me and said, if it was not my brother, but Smerdyakov committed the murder, for the legend was circulating everywhere that Smerdyakov had done it. Perhaps I too am guilty, for Smerdyakov knew I didn't like my father and perhaps believed that I desired my father's death. Then I brought out that letter and showed it him. He was entirely convinced that his brother had done it, and he was overwhelmed by it. He couldn't endure the thought that his own brother was a parricide. Only a week ago I saw that it was making him ill. During the last few days he's talked incoherently in my presence. I saw his mind was giving way. He walked about raving. He was seen muttering in the streets. The doctor from Moscow, at my request, examined him the day before yesterday and told me that he was on the eve of brain fever. And all on his account, on account of this monster. And last night he learned that Smerdyakov was dead. It was such a shock that it drove him out of his mind. And all through this monster, all for the sake of saving the monster.
Oh, of course, such an outpouring, such an avowal, is only possible once in a lifetime. At the hour of death, for instance, on the way to the scaffold. But it was in Katya's character, and it was such a moment in her life. It was the same impetuous Katya who had thrown herself on the mercy of a young profligate to save her father. The same Katya who had just before, in her pride and chastity, sacrificed herself and her maidenly modesty before all these people, telling of Mitya's generous conduct in the hope of softening his fate a little. And now again she sacrificed herself, but this time it was for another. And perhaps only now, perhaps only at this moment, she felt anew how dear that other was to her. She had sacrificed herself in terror for him, conceiving all of a sudden that he had ruined himself by his confession, that it was he who had committed the murder, not his brother. She had sacrificed herself to save him, to save his good name, his reputation. And yet one terrible doubt occurred to one. Was she lying in her description of her former relations with Mitya? That was the question. No, she had not intentionally slandered him when she cried that Mitya despised her for her bowing down to him. She believed it herself. She had been firmly convinced, perhaps ever since that bow, that the simple-hearted Mitya, who even then adored her, was laughing at her and despising her. She had loved him with an hysterical, lacerated love, only from pride, from wounded pride. And that love was not like love, but more like revenge. Oh, perhaps that lacerated love would have grown into real love. Perhaps Katya longed for nothing more than that. But Mitya's faithlessness had wounded her to the bottom of her heart, and her heart could not forgive him. The moment of revenge had come upon her suddenly, and all that had been accumulating so long and so painfully in the offended woman's breast burst out all at once and unexpectedly. She betrayed Mitya, but she betrayed herself too, and no sooner had she given full expression to her feelings than the tension, of course, was over, and she was overwhelmed with shame. Hysterics began again. She fell on the floor, sobbing and screaming. She was carried out. At that moment Grushenka, with a wail, rushed towards Mitya before they had time to prevent her. "Mitya," she wailed, "your servant has destroyed you. There she's shown you what she is," she shouted to the judges, shaking with anger. At a signal from the president, they seized her and tried to remove her from the court. She wouldn't allow it. She fought and struggled to get back to Mitya. Mitya uttered a cry and struggled to get to her. He was overpowered. Yes, I think the ladies who came to see the spectacle must have been satisfied. The show had been a varied one. Then I remember the Moscow doctor appeared on the scene. I believe the president had previously sent the court usher to arrange for medical aid for Ivan. The doctor announced to the court that the sick man was suffering from a dangerous attack of brain fever and that he must be at once removed. In answer to questions from the prosecutor and the counsel for the defense, He said that the patient had come to him of his own accord the day before yesterday, and that he'd warned him that he had such an attack coming on, but he had not consented to be looked after.
He was certainly not in a normal state of mind. He told me himself that he saw visions when he was awake, that he met several persons in the street who were dead, and that Satan visited him every evening,
said the doctor in conclusion. Having given his evidence, the celebrated doctor withdrew. The letter produced by Katerina Ivanovna was added to the material proofs. After some deliberation, the judges decided to proceed with the trial and to enter both the unexpected pieces of evidence, given by Ivan and Katerina Ivanovna, on the protocol. But I will not detail the evidence of the other witnesses, who only repeated and confirmed what had been said before, though all with their characteristic peculiarities. I repeat, all was brought together in the prosecutor's speech, which I shall quote immediately. Everyone was excited, everyone was electrified by the late catastrophe, and all were awaiting the speeches for the prosecution and the defence with intense impatience. Fetyukovitch was obviously shaken by Katerina Ivanovna's evidence, but the prosecutor was triumphant. When all the evidence had been taken, the court was adjourned for almost an hour. I believe it was just 8 o'clock when the president returned to his seat, and our prosecutor, Ippolit Kirillovich, began his speech. Chapter 6. The Prosecutor's Speech, Sketches of Character. Ippolit Kirillovich began his speech, trembling with nervousness, with cold sweat on his forehead, feeling hot and cold all over by turns. He described this himself afterwards. He regarded this speech as his chef d'oeuvre, the chef d'oeuvre of his whole life, as his swan song. He died, it is true, 9 months later, of rapid consumption, so that he had the right, as it turned out, to compare himself to a swan singing his last song. He had put his whole heart and all the brain he had into that speech, and poor Ippolit Kirillovich unexpectedly revealed that at least some feeling for the public welfare and the eternal question lay concealed in him. Where his speech really excelled was in its sincerity. He genuinely believed in the prisoner's guilt. He was accusing him not as an official duty only, and in calling for vengeance he quivered with a genuine passion for the security of society. Even the ladies in the audience, though they remained hostile to Ippolit Kirillovich, admitted that he made an extraordinary impression on them. He began in a breaking voice, but it soon gained strength and filled the court to the end of his speech. But as soon as he had finished, he almost fainted.
"Gentlemen of the jury," began the prosecutor, "this case has made a stir throughout Russia. But what is there to wonder at? What is there so peculiarly horrifying in it for us? We are so accustomed to such crimes. That's what's so horrible, that such dark deeds have ceased to horrify us. What ought to horrify us is that we are so accustomed to it, and not this or that isolated crime. What are the causes of our indifference, our lukewarm attitude to such deeds, to such signs of the times, ominous of an unenviable future? Is it our cynicism? Is it the premature exhaustion of intellect and imagination in a society that is sinking into decay in spite of its youth? Is it that our moral principles are shattered to their foundations? Or is it perhaps a complete lack of such principles among us? I cannot answer such questions. Nevertheless, they are disturbing, and every citizen not only must, but ought to be harassed by them. Our newborn and still timid press has done good service to the public already, for without it we should never have heard of the horrors of unbridled violence and moral degradation, which are continually made known by the press, not merely to those who attend the new jury courts established in the present reign, but to everyone. And what do we read almost daily? Of things beside which the present case grows pale and seems almost commonplace. But what is most important is that the majority of our national crimes of violence bear witness to a widespread evil, now so general among us that it is difficult to contend against it. One day we see a brilliant young officer of high society, at the very outset of his career, in a cowardly, underhand way, without a pang of conscience, murdering an official who had once been his benefactor, and the servant girl to steal his own IOU and what ready money he could find on him. It will come in handy for my pleasures in the fashionable world and for my career in the future. After murdering them, he puts pillows under the head of each of his victims. He goes away. Next, a young hero, decorated for bravery, kills the mother of his chief and benefactor, like a highwayman, and to urge his companions to join him, he asserts that she loves him like a son, and so will follow all his directions and take no precautions. Granted that he is a monster, yet I dare not say in these days that he is unique. Another man will not commit the murder, but will feel and think like him, and is as dishonorable in soul. In silence, alone with his conscience, he asks himself, perhaps, what is honor, and isn't the condemnation of bloodshed a prejudice? Perhaps people will cry out against me that I am morbid, hysterical, that it is a monstrous slander, that I am exaggerating. Let them say so, and, heavens, I should be the first to rejoice if it were so. Oh, don't believe me. Think of me as morbid, but remember my words. If only a tenth, if only a twentieth part of what I say is true, even so, it's awful. Look how our young people commit suicide without asking themselves Hamlet's question, what is there beyond? Without a sign of such a question as all that relates to the soul and to what awaits us beyond the grave, had long been erased in their minds and buried under the sands. Look at our vice and our profligates. Fyodor Pavlovich, the luckless victim in the present case, was almost an innocent babe compared with many of them. And yet we all knew him. He lived among us. Yes, one day perhaps the leading intellects of Russia and of Europe will study the psychology of Russian crime, for the subject is worth it. But this study will come later, at leisure, when all the tragic topsy-turvydom of today is further behind us, so that it's possible to examine it with more insight and more impartiality than I can do. Now, we are either horrified or pretend to be horrified, though we really gloat over the spectacle and love strong and eccentric sensations which tickle our cynical, pampered idleness. Or, like little children, we brush the dreadful ghosts away and hide our heads in the pillows so as to return to our sports and merriment as soon as they have vanished. But we must one day begin life in sober earnest. We must look at ourselves as a society. It's time we try to grasp something of our social position, or at least to make a beginning in that direction. A great writer of the last epoch, Gogol is meant, comparing Russia to a swift troika galloping to an unknown goal, exclaims, "Oh, troika, bird-like troika, who invented thee?" and adds in proud ecstasy that all the people of the world stand aside respectfully to make way for the recklessly galloping troika to pass. That may be, they may stand aside, respectfully or no. But in my poor opinion, the great writer ended his book in this way, either in an access of childish and naive optimism, or simply in fear of the censorship of the day. For if the troika were drawn by his heroes, Sobakovich, Nozdryov, Chichikov, it could reach no rational goal, whoever might be driving it. And those were the heroes of an older generation. Ours are worse specimens still.
At this point, Ippolit Kirillovich's speech was interrupted by applause. The liberal significance of this simile was appreciated. The applause was, it's true, of brief duration, so that the president did not think it necessary to caution the public, and only looked severely in the direction of the offenders. But Ippolit Kirillovich was encouraged. He'd never been applauded before. He'd been all his life unable to get a hearing, and now he suddenly had an opportunity of securing the ear of all Russia.
What, after all, is the Karamazov family which has gained such an unenviable notoriety throughout Russia? He continued. Perhaps I'm exaggerating, but it seems to me that certain fundamental features of the educated class of today are reflected in this family picture, only, of course, in miniature, like the sun in a drop of water. Think of that unhappy, vicious, unbridled old man who has met with such a melancholy end, the head of a family. Beginning life of noble birth, but in a poor, dependent position, Through an unexpected marriage he came into a small fortune. A petty knave, a toady and buffoon, a fairly good, though undeveloped intelligence. He was above all a money-lender, who grew bolder with growing prosperity. His abject and servile characteristics disappeared. His malicious and sarcastic cynicism was all that remained. On the spiritual side, he was undeveloped, while his vitality was excessive. He saw nothing in life but sensual pleasure, and he brought his children up to be the same. He had no feelings for his duties as a father. He ridiculed those duties. He left his little children to the servants and was glad to be rid of them, forgot about them completely. The old man's maxim was, après moi le déluge. He was an example of everything that is opposed to civic duty, of the most complex and malignant individualism. The world may burn for aught I care, so long as I am all right. And he was all right. He was content, he was eager to go on living in the same way for another 20 or 30 years. He swindled his own son and spent his money, his maternal inheritance, on trying to get his mistress from him. No, I don't intend to leave the prisoner's defense altogether to my talented colleague from Petersburg. I will speak the truth myself. I can well understand what resentment he had heaped up in his son's heart against him. But enough, enough of that unhappy old man. He has paid the penalty. Let us remember, however, that he was a father, and one of the typical fathers of today. Am I unjust indeed in saying that he is typical of many modern fathers? Alas, many of them only differ in not openly professing such cynicism, for they are better educated, more cultured. But their philosophy is essentially the same as his. Perhaps I'm a pessimist, but you have agreed to forgive me. Let us agree beforehand. You need not believe me, but let me speak. Let me say what I have to say and remember something of my words. Now, for the children of this father, this head of a family, one of them is the prisoner before us. All the rest of my speech will deal with him. Of the other two, I will speak only cursorily. The elder is one of those modern young men of brilliant education and vigorous intellect, who has lost all faith in everything. He has denied and rejected much already, like his father. We have all heard him. He was a welcome guest in local society. He never concealed his opinions, quite the contrary, in fact, which justifies me in speaking rather openly of him now, of course not as an individual, but as a member of the Karamazov family. Another personage closely connected with the case died here by his own hand last night. I mean an afflicted idiot, formerly the servant, possibly the illegitimate son of Fyodor Pavlovich Smerdyakov. At the preliminary inquiry, he told me with hysterical tears how the young Ivan Karamazov had horrified him by his spiritual audacity. Everything in the world is lawful, according to him, and nothing must be forbidden in the future. That is what he always taught me. I believe that idiot was driven out of his mind by this theory, though, of course, the epileptic attacks from which he suffered and this terrible catastrophe have helped to unhinge his faculties. But he dropped one very interesting observation which would have done credit to a more intelligent observer, and that is indeed why I've mentioned it. If there is one of the sons that is like Fyodor Pavlovich in character, it is Ivan Fyodorovich. With that remark, I conclude my sketch of his character, feeling it indelicate to continue further. Oh, I don't want to draw any further conclusions and croak like a raven over the young man's future. We've seen today in this court that there are still good impulses in his young heart. That family feeling has not been destroyed in him by lack of faith and cynicism, which has come to him rather by inheritance than by the exercise of independent thought. Then the third son. Oh, he is a devout and modest youth who does not share his elder brother's gloomy and destructive theory of life. He has sought to cling to the ideas of the people, or to what goes by that name in some circles of our intellectual classes.
He clung to the monastery and was within an ace of becoming a monk. He seems to me to have betrayed unconsciously and so early that timid despair which leads so many in our unhappy society, who dread cynicism and its corrupting influences, and mistakenly attribute all the mischief to European enlightenment, to return to their native soil, as they say, to the bosom, so to speak, of their mother earth, like frightened children, yearning to fall asleep on the withered bosom of their decrepit mother, and to sleep there forever, only to escape the horrors that terrify them. For my part, I wish the excellent and gifted young man every success. I trust that his youthful idealism and impulse towards the ideas of the people may never degenerate, as often happens, on the moral side into gloomy mysticism, and on the political into blind chauvinism, two elements which are even a greater menace to Russia than the premature decay due to misunderstanding and gratuitous adoption of European ideas, from which his elder brother is suffering.
Two or three people clapped their hands at the mention of chauvinism and mysticism. Ippolit Kirillovich had been, indeed, carried away by his own eloquence. All this had little to do with the case in hand, to say nothing of the fact of its being somewhat vague, but the sickly and consumptive man was overcome by the desire to express himself once in his life. People said afterwards that he was actuated by unworthy motives in his criticism of Ivan, because the latter had on one or two occasions got the better of him in argument, and Ippolit Kirillovich, remembering it, tried now to take his revenge. But I don't know whether it was true. All this was only introductory, however, and the speech passed to more direct consideration of the case.
"But to return to the eldest son," Ippolit Kirillovich went on, "he is the prisoner before us. We have his life and his actions, too, before us. The fatal day has come, and all has been brought to the surface. While his brothers seem to stand for Europeanism and the principles of the people, he seems to represent Russia as she is. Oh, not all Russia, not all. God preserve us if it were. Yet here we have her, our mother Russia, the very scent and sound of her. Oh, he is spontaneous. He is a marvellous mingling of good and evil. He is a lover of culture and Schiller. Yet he brawls in taverns and plucks out the beards of his boon companions. Oh, he too can be good and noble, but only when all goes well with him. What is more, he can be carried off his feet, positively carried off his feet, by noble ideals, but only if they come of themselves, if they fall from heaven for him, if they need not be paid for. He dislikes paying for anything, but is very fond of receiving, and that's so with him in everything. Oh, give him every possible good in life. He couldn't be content with less, and put no obstacle in his way, and he will show that he too can be noble. He is not greedy, no, but he must have money, a great deal of money, and you will see how generously, with what scorn of filthy lucre, he will fling it all away in the reckless dissipation of one night. But if he has not money, he will show what he is ready to do to get it when he is in great need of it. But all is later. Let us take events in their chronological order. First, we have before us a poor, abandoned child running about the backyard, without boots on his feet, as our worthy and esteemed fellow citizen of foreign origin, alas, expressed it just now. I repeat it again, I yield to no one the defense of the criminal. I am here to accuse him, but to defend him also. Yes, I too am human. I too can weigh the influence of home and childhood on the character. But the boy grows up and becomes an officer. For a duel and other reckless conduct, he is exiled to one of the remote frontier towns of Russia. There he led a wild life as an officer. And, of course, he needed money. Money before all things.
and so after prolonged disputes he came to a settlement with his father, and the last 6,000 was sent him. A letter is in existence in which he practically gives up his claim to the rest and settles his conflict with his father over the inheritance on the payment of this 6,000.
"An unseemly farce which I foresaw when I came here," cried Dmitri indignantly. He too leapt up. "Forgive it, Reverend Father," he added, addressing the elder. "I'm not a cultivated man and don't even know how to address you properly. But you have been deceived, and you've been too good-natured in letting us meet here. All my father wants is a scandal. Why he wants it, only he can tell. He always has some motive, but I believe I know why."
"They all blame me, all of them," cried Fyodor Pavlovich in his turn. "Pyotr Alexandrovich here blames me, too." "You have been blaming me, Pyotr Alexandrovich, you have."
He turned suddenly to Byusov, although the latter was not dreaming of interrupting him.
"They all accuse me of having hidden the children's money in my boots and cheated them. But isn't there a court of law? There they will reckon out for you, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, from your notes, your letters, and your agreements, how much money you had, how much you have spent, and how much you have left. Why does Pyotr Alexandrovich refuse to pass judgment? Dmitri is not a stranger to him, because they're all against me, while Dmitri Fyodorovitch is in debt to me, and not a little, but some thousands of which I have documentary proof. The whole town is echoing with his debaucheries, and where he was stationed before, he several times spent 1,000 or 2 for the seduction of some respectable girl. We know all about that, Dmitri Fyodorovitch, in its most secret details, and I'll prove it. Would you believe it, Holy Father, he has captivated the heart of the most honourable of young ladies of good family and fortune, daughter of a gallant colonel, formerly his superior officer, who had received many honours and had the Anna Order on his breast. He compromised the girl by his promise of marriage. Now she is an orphan and here. She is betrothed to him, yet before her very eyes he is dancing attendance on a certain enchantress. And although this enchantress has lived in, so to speak, civil marriage with a respectable man, yet she is of an independent character, an unapproachable fortress for everybody, just like a legal wife. For she is virtuous, yes, Holy Father, she is virtuous. Dmitri Fyodorovitch wants to open this fortress with a golden key, and that's why he's insolent to me now, trying to get money from me, though he had wasted thousands on this enchantress already. He's continually borrowing money for the purpose. From whom do you think? Shall I say, Mitya?
Be silent, cried Dmitri. Wait till I'm gone. Don't dare in my presence to asperse the good name of an honourable girl. That you should utter a word about her is an outrage, and I won't permit it.
He was breathless.
Mitya, Mitya,
cried Fyodor Pavlovich hysterically, squeezing out a tear.
And is your father's blessing nothing to you? If I curse you, what then? Shameless hypocrite! Exclaimed Dmitri furiously. He says that to his father, his father. What would he be with others? Gentlemen only fancy there's a poor but honourable man living here burdened with a numerous family. A captain who got into trouble and was discharged from the army, but not publicly, not by court-martial, with no slur on his honour. And 3 weeks ago Dmitri seized him by the beard in a tavern, dragged him out into the street and beat him publicly, and all because he is an agent in a little business of mine. It's all a lie. Outwardly it's the truth, but inwardly a lie. Dmitri was trembling with rage. Father, I don't justify my action. Yes, I confess it publicly. I behaved like a brute to that captain, and I regret it now, and I'm disgusted with myself for my brutal rage. But this captain, this agent of yours, went to that lady whom you call an enchantress, and suggested to her from you that she should take IOUs of mine which were in your possession and should sue me for the money so as to get me into prison by means of them, if I persisted in claiming an account from you of my property. Now you reproach me for having a weakness for that lady when you yourself incited her to captivate me. She told me so to my face. She told me the story and laughed at you. You wanted to put me in prison because you are jealous of me with her, because you'd begun to force your attentions upon her. And I know all about that, too. She laughed at you for that as well. You hear? She laughed at you as she described it. So, here, you have this man, this father who reproaches his profligate son. Gentlemen, forgive my anger, but I foresaw that this crafty old man had only brought you together to create a scandal. I had come to forgive him if he held out his hand, to forgive him and ask forgiveness. But as he has just this minute insulted not only me, but an honourable young lady of whom I feel such reverence that I dare not take her name in vain, I have made up my mind to show up his game, though he is my father.
He could not go on. His eyes were glittering, and he breathed with difficulty. But everyone in the cell was stirred. All except Father Sozimo got up from their seats uneasily. The monks looked austere, but waited for guidance from the elder. He sat still, pale, not from excitement, but from the weakness of disease. An imploring smile lighted up his face. From time to time he raised his hand as though to check the storm, and, of course, a gesture from him would have been enough to end the scene. But he seemed to be waiting for something, and watched them intently as though trying to make out something which was not perfectly clear to him. At last, Miusov felt completely humiliated and disgraced.
"We're all to blame for this scandalous scene," he said hotly, "but I did not foresee it when I came, though I knew with whom I had to deal. This must be stopped at once. Believe me, Your Reverence, I had no precise knowledge of the details that have just come to light. I was unwilling to believe them, and I learned for the first time. A father is jealous of his son's relations with a woman of loose behaviour, and intrigues with the creature to get his son into prison. This is the company in which I have been forced to be present. I was deceived. I declare to you all that I was as much deceived as anyone."
"Dmitri Fyodorovitch!"
yelled Fyodor Pavlovitch suddenly, in an unnatural voice.
"If you were not my son, I would challenge you this instant to a duel, with pistols at three paces across a handkerchief,"
he ended, stamping with both feet. With old liars who have been acting all their lives, there are moments when they enter so completely into their part that they tremble or shed tears of emotion in earnest, although at that very moment, or a second later, they are able to whisper to themselves, "You know you are lying, you shameless old sinner. You're acting now in spite of your holy wrath."
Then came his meeting with a young girl of lofty character and brilliant education. Oh, I do not venture to repeat the details. You have only just heard them. Honour, self-sacrifice was shown there, and I will be silent. The figure of the young officer, frivolous and profligate, doing homage to true nobility and a lofty ideal, was shown in a very sympathetic light before us, but the other side of the medal was unexpectedly turned to us immediately after in this very court. Again, I will not venture to conjecture why it happened so, but there were causes. The same lady, bathed in tears of long-concealed indignation, alleged that he of all men, had despised her for her action, which, though incautious, reckless perhaps, was still dictated by lofty and generous motives. He, the girl's betrothed, looked at her with that smile of mockery, which was more insufferable from him than from anyone, and knowing that he had already deceived her, he had deceived her, believing that she was bound to endure everything from him, even treachery. She intentionally offered him 3,000 rubles and clearly, too clearly, let him understand that she was offering him money to deceive her. "Well, will you take it or not? Are you so lost to shame?" was the dumb question in her scrutinizing eyes. He looked at her, saw clearly what was in her mind. He's admitted here before you that he understood it all. Appropriated that 3,000 unconditionally, and squandered it in 2 days with the new object of his affections. What are we to believe, then? The first legend of the young officer sacrificing his last farthing in a noble impulse of generosity, and doing reverence to virtue, or this other revolting picture? As a rule, between two extremes, one has to find the mean, but in the present case this is not true.
The probability is that in the first case he was genuinely noble, and in the second as genuinely base. And why? Because he was of the broad Karamazov character. That's just what I'm leading up to. Capable of combining the most incongruous contradictions, and capable of the greatest heights and of the greatest depths. Remember the brilliant remark made by a young observer who has seen the Karamazov family close quarters, Mr. Rakitin. The sense of their own degradation is as essential to these reckless, unbridled natures as the sense of their lofty generation. And that's true. They need continually this unnatural mixture. Two extremes at the same moment, or they're miserable and dissatisfied and their existence is incomplete. They're wide, wide as Mother Russia. They include everything and put up with everything. By the way, gentlemen of the jury, we've just touched upon that 3,000 rubles, and I will venture to anticipate things a little. Can you conceive that a man like that, on receiving that sum and in such a way, at the price of such shame, such disgrace, such utter degradation, could have been capable that very day of setting apart half that sum? That very day, and sewing it up in a little bag, and would have had the firmness of character to carry it about with him for a whole month afterwards, in spite of every temptation and his extreme need of it, neither in drunken debauchery in taverns, nor when he was flying into the country, trying to get from God knows whom the money so essential to him to remove the object of his affections from being tempted by his father. Did he bring himself to touch that little bag? Why, if only to avoid abandoning his mistress to the rival of whom he was so jealous, he would have been certain to have opened that bag and to have stayed at home to keep watch over her, and to await the moment when she would say to him at last, "I am yours," and to fly with her far from their fatal surroundings. But no, he did not touch his talisman, and what is the reason he gives for it? The chief reason, as I have just said, was that when she would say, "I am yours, take me where you will," he might have the wherewithal to take her. But that first reason, in the prisoner's own words, was of little weight beside the second. "While I have that money on me," he said, "I am a scoundrel, not a thief, for I can always go to my insulted betrothed, and laying down half the sum I have fraudulently appropriated, I can always say to her, 'You see, I've squandered half your money and shown I am a weak and immoral man, and if you like, a scoundrel.' I use the prisoner's own expression. But though I am a scoundrel, I'm not a thief, for if I'd been a thief, I shouldn't have brought you back this half of the money, but should have taken it as I did the other half." A marvellous explanation. This frantic but weak man who could not resist the temptation of accepting the 3,000 rubles at the price of such disgrace, this very man suddenly develops the most stoical firmness and carries about 1,000 rubles without daring to touch it. Does that fit in at all with the character we have analysed? No. And I venture to tell you how the real Dmitri Karamazov would have behaved in such circumstances, if he really had brought himself to put away the money. At the first temptation, for instance, to entertain the woman with whom he'd already squandered half the money, he would have unpicked his little bag and have taken out some 100 rubles. For why should he have taken back precisely half the money, that is 1,500 rubles? Why not 1,400? He could just as well have said then that he was not a thief because he brought back 1,400 rubles. Then another time he would have unpicked it again and taken out another 100, and then a third, and then a fourth. And before the end of the month he would have taken the last note but one, feeling that if he took back only 100 it would answer the purpose, for a thief would have stolen it all. And then he would have looked at this last note and have said to himself, "It's really not worthwhile to give back 100. Let's spend that, too." That's how the real Dmitri Karamazov, as we know him, would have behaved. One cannot imagine anything more incongruous with the actual fact than this legend of the little bag. Nothing could be more inconceivable. But we shall return to that later.
After touching upon what had come out in the proceedings concerning the financial relations of father and son, and arguing again and again that it was utterly impossible, from the facts known, to determine which was in the wrong, Ippolit Kirillovich passed to the evidence of the medical experts in reference to Mitya's fixed idea about the 3,000 owing to him. Chapter 7. An Historical Survey.
The medical experts have striven to convince us that the prisoner is out of his mind and, in fact, a maniac. I maintain that he is in his right mind, and that if he had not been, he would have behaved more cleverly. As for his being a maniac, that I would agree with, but only in one point, that is, his fixed idea about the 3,000. Yet I think one might find a much simpler cause than his tendency to insanity. For my part, I agree thoroughly with the young doctor who maintained that the prisoner's mental faculties have always been normal, and that he has only been irritable and exasperated. The object of the prisoner's continual and violent anger was not the sum itself. There was a special motive at the bottom of it. That motive is jealousy.
Here Ippolit Kirillovich described at length the prisoner's fatal passion for Grushenka. He began from the moment when the prisoner went to the young person's lodgings to beat her.
I use his own expression, the prosecutor explained. But instead of beating her, he remained there at her feet. That was the beginning of the passion. At the same time, the prisoner's father was captivated by the same young person. A strange and fatal coincidence, for they both lost their hearts to her simultaneously, though both had known her before. And she inspired in both of them the most violent, characteristically Karamazov passion. We have our own confession. I was laughing at both of them. Yes, the sudden desire to make a jest of them came over her, and she conquered both of them at once. The old man, who worshipped money, at once set aside 3,000 rubles as a reward for one visit from her. But soon after that he would have been happy to lay his property in his name at her feet, if only she would become his lawful wife. We have good evidence of this. As for the prisoner, the tragedy of his fate is evident. It is before us. But each was the young person's game. The enchantress gave the unhappy young man no hope until the last moment, when he knelt before her, stretching out hands that were already stained with the blood of his father and rival. It was in that position that he was arrested. Send me to Siberia with him. I have brought him to this. I am most to blame. The woman herself cried in genuine remorse at the moment of his arrest. The talented young man, to whom I have referred already, Mr. Rakitin, characterized this heroine in brief and impressive terms. She was disillusioned early in life, deceived and ruined by a betrothed who seduced and abandoned her. She was left in poverty, cursed by her respectable family, and taken under the protection of a wealthy old man whom she still, however, considers as her benefactor. There was perhaps much that was good in her young heart, but it was embittered too early. She became prudent and saved money. She grew sarcastic and resentful against society. After this sketch of her character, it may well be understood that she might laugh at both of them, simply from mischief, from malice. After a month of hopeless love and moral degradation, during which he betrayed his betrothed and appropriated money entrusted to his honour, the prisoner was driven almost to frenzy, almost to madness, by continual jealousy. And of whom? His father! And the worst of it was that the crazy old man was alluring and enticing the object of his affection by means of that very 3,000 rubles which the son looked upon as his own property, part of his inheritance from his mother, of which his father was cheating him. Yes, I admit, it was hard to bear. It might well drive a man to madness. It was not the money, but the fact that this money was used with such revolting cynicism to ruin his happiness.
Then the prosecutor went on to describe how the idea of murdering his father had entered the prisoner's head, and illustrated his theory with facts. At first he only talked about it in taverns. He was talking about it all that month. Ah, he likes being always surrounded with company, and he likes to tell his companions everything, even his most diabolical and dangerous ideas. He likes to share every thought with others,
and expects for some reason that those he confides in will meet him with perfect sympathy, enter into all his troubles and anxieties, take his part and not oppose him in anything. If not, he flies into a rage and smashes up everything in the tavern.
Then followed the anecdote about Captain Snegiryov.
Those who heard the prisoner began to think at last that he might mean more than threats, and that such a frenzy might turn threats into actions.
Here the prosecutor described the meeting of the family at the monastery, the conversations with Alyosha, and the horrible scene of violence when the prisoner rushed into his father's house just after dinner.
I cannot positively assert, the prosecutor continued, that the prisoner fully intended to murder his father before that incident. Yet the idea had several times presented itself to him, and he had deliberated on it. For that we have facts, witnesses, and his own words. I confess, gentlemen of the jury, he added, that till today I've been uncertain whether to attribute to the prisoner conscious premeditation. I was firmly convinced that he had pictured the fatal moment beforehand, but had only pictured it, contemplating it as a possibility. He had not definitely considered when and how he might commit the crime. But I was only uncertain till today, till that fatal document was presented to the court just now. You yourselves heard that young lady's exclamation, "It is the plan, the program of the murder." That is how she defined that miserable drunken letter of the unhappy prisoner. And in fact, from that letter we see that the whole fact of the murder was premeditated. It was written 2 days before, and so we know now for a fact that 48 hours before the perpetration of his terrible design, the prisoner swore that if he could not get money next day, he would murder his father in order to take the envelope with the notes from under his pillow, as soon as Ivan had left. As soon as Ivan had gone away. You hear that? So he had thought everything out, weighing every circumstance, and he carried it all out just as he'd written it. The proof of premeditation is conclusive. The crime must have been committed for the sake of the money. That is stated clearly, that is written and signed. The prisoner does not deny his signature. I shall be told he was drunk when he wrote it, but that does not diminish the value of the letter, quite the contrary. He wrote when drunk what he had planned when sober. Had he not planned it when sober, he would not have written it when drunk. I shall be asked, then why did he talk about it in taverns? A man who premeditates such a crime is silent and keeps it to himself. Yes, but he talked about it before he had formed a plan, when he had only the desire, only the impulse to it. Afterwards he talked less about it. On the evening he wrote that letter at the Metropolis Tavern, contrary to his custom, he was silent, though he had been drinking. He did not play billiards, he sat in a corner, talked to no one. He did indeed turn a shop man out of his seat, but that was done almost unconsciously, because he could never enter a tavern without making a disturbance. It is true that after he had taken the final decision, he must have felt apprehensive that he'd talked too much about his design beforehand, and that this might lead to his arrest and prosecution afterwards. But there was nothing for it, he could not take his words back. But his luck had served him before, it would serve him again. He believed in his star, you know. I must confess, too, that he did a great deal to avoid the fatal catastrophe. Tomorrow I shall try and borrow the money from everyone, as he writes in his peculiar language, and if they won't give it to me, there will be bloodshed.
Here Ippolit Kirillovich passed to a detailed description of all Mitya's efforts to borrow the money. He described his visit to Samsonov, his journey to Liagavi.
Harassed, jeered at, hungry, after selling his watch to pay for the journey, though he tells us he had 1,500 rubles on him, a likely story. Tortured by jealousy at having left the object of his affections in the town, suspecting that she would go to Fyodor Pavlovich in his absence, he returned at last to the town to find, to his joy, that she had not been near his father. He accompanied her himself to her protector. Strange to say, he doesn't seem to have been jealous of Samsonov, which is psychologically interesting. Then he hastens back to his ambush in the back gardens, and there learns that Smerdyakov is in a fit, that the other servant is ill, the coast is clear, and he knows the signals. What a temptation! Still, he resisted. He goes off to a lady who has for some time been residing in the town and who is highly esteemed among us, Madame Holokov. That lady, who had long watched his career with compassion, gave him the most